Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of my podcast this week is Robert Lodewijks, co-founder and CEO of Hulo AI.
We have one really clear definition, and that is in the amount of water that we have saved. So in the end, that relates to all our goals, because if we save so many Olympic-sized swimming pools of drinking water, which is 4 billion, is our BHAG, how you want to call it, then it also means that we probably built a very profitable company that also means that we made a huge impact on the world.
This is Robert. He's an entrepreneur who understands the delicate balance between patience and ambition. His journey began with a profound realization during his studies in Taiwan that impact requires more than just good technology. What makes Robert's story intriguing is his methodical approach, spending 4 years in research before launching, then bootstrapping to validate, and only then accelerating with venture funding. And this disciplined progression showcased a rare blend of scientific rigor and entrepreneurial instinct. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Robert to my podcast. We explore how early stage founders can build confidence through validation rather than rushing to scale. His insights reveal how methodological customer development, thoughtful bootstrapping, and strategic timing of funding can create a stronger foundation for growth. What's particularly fascinating is his scientific approach to sales and his insights on avoiding the common pitfalls of enterprise customer development. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn 4 things. Firstly, that patient validation beats premature scaling because it builds stronger foundations. Secondly, how to avoid pure sales hustle and having to rely on individual talent to secure the growth of your SaaS business. Thirdly, how to get everyone aligned in your company to create business velocity, not just departmental speed. And lastly, why you should always start your validation process with the end user rather than just decision makers. Well, hi, Robert. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's my pleasure to be here.
It's indeed a pleasure for me as well. It's a topic dear to my heart, also because of what I've learned throughout the years about the global problem that water is actually creating. So before we start talking about like how you're solving this with the company Hulo, or in Dutch, Hulo, what drives you? What do you get energy from?
I really like that question because I think having a company and wanting to do something, you have to have a drive to do something. So so for me, it all started actually some time ago. So I did my studies in the Netherlands, but I also studied some time abroad. I went to Taiwan. And actually in the Netherlands, I grew up in a nice, warm, cozy family, you know, everything well arranged. But then at some point there, you also see the different parts of the world. So traveling around in Asia. And for some reason, that always kind of inspired me a bit to, you know, you want to do something that is, meaningful, maybe put it like that. So I didn't know what to do, but at least I knew I wanted to do something with impact, so to say. And then accidentally, I ended up in the water sector and got to know a bit more about, okay, hey, what is actually water all about? And what are the challenges? What are the opportunities? That really got me out of, inspired me, so to say. Yeah, then at some point you start thinking like, hey, what do I actually want to do? You know, like what drives me? And in short, it's about impact. But nowadays I always put it like this, like if I'm 80 years old and I can tell my grandchildren like, hey, you know, we helped communities across the world to have better access to clean drinking water. Yeah, then the adventure is successful, I would say. So yeah, you could say that that is my drive.
Nice. I mean, I completely agree. It's always far more inspiring to lead with something that people can actually visibly see and appreciate. And I mean, what for much more tangible than saying, okay, because you're drinking the water here because I helped to make it available, to keep it available for you. Wow. All right. So, I mean, normally my question is, what's the mission you're on? That's clear. But yeah, to zoom a little bit into that. What was the big problem that you saw that sparked the idea to see what you could do with technology to stop it, to improve it?
Now, first of all, we didn't really see the problem ourselves. So yeah, it sounds a bit stupid maybe, but if you go back at where we started, actually the water utilities in the Netherlands, they came up with a challenge actually, where they got in touch with a research institute which is called Wetzes here in Leeuwarden, which is actually called the capital of water technology. So if you drive in the city, you see it on the signs. But in short, they come up with a challenge like, hey, we have a water network, and yeah, sometimes water is leaking, and it's hard for us to understand when it is leaking, how big it is, the leak, and also where it is leaking. And then of course you start looking into it a bit more and more, and then actually you come to the shocking numbers that worldwide 30% of all drinking water that is produced is lost through leaks. So and then we realize that in the Netherlands actually we're doing quite well, like we lose approximately 5% on average, where indeed internationally it's a way bigger problem, as you might want to call it, or challenge. So yeah, that's the bigger problem. And then of course if you zoom in, yeah, each utilities has its own challenges on, okay, how to tackle that problem. So yeah, that's a bit how the problem that is overarching this yeah, this thing we do.
Well, I mean, I was aware that it's there's a lot of leakage. I wasn't aware that it's 30% of the worldwide,
Yeah, it's really
consumption.
crazy. It's like if you go to the supermarket and you throw away 30% of your groceries, like that's, you know, it's hard to imagine, but yeah,
Yeah,
unfortunately it is.
particularly of course, also because it's becoming a scarce good. And I mean, I know I live in Spain. I know how the water management is happening here, whereby sometimes in summer, government or local authorities just turn the knob off. You know, there's no water tonight. Good luck
And
with the showering.
you know what's funny? You're Dutch as well, so I can have this discussion with you. So, actually, in the Netherlands, this awareness amongst people isn't really there yet. Of course, we now see more and more in the news with hot summers, like, ooh, you know, water is a challenge. And actually, water also plays a different role. So sometimes we have too much water, you know, with and stuff. Now in Spain, you recently had this issue, of course, which was a big drama in Valencia. But that is, I think, in general, the kind of awareness that we need to create amongst all the people that water is actually in the middle of everything. So if we talk about climate change, actually we should also talk about water and the role of water in it. Because where we in the Netherlands, for example, used to treat water like, okay, get it as soon as possible to the sea, now we should also think about, okay, how can we capture water in a better way? And so it's not like one-sided challenge. Water is so broad, and we're just one part of it. But the creating this awareness amongst people, yeah, also, yeah, it feels like a responsibility for us to do.
It is a responsibility. And I mean, when I had Max Gould on my podcast, I think 2 years ago, he was talking about water management, but then from satellite's perspective, at least from sort of from the from outside of Earth, and then looking at the Earth to see where the problems really are and what we could do about it. He was talking about a global problem that was just seven harvests away. So that's five now. And you don't realize it because, you know, water at the end, if there's no water, nothing grows. And if nothing grows, then there is no, you know, it impacts everybody and everything You know, we cannot eat and so on, which is a big problem. Well, so yeah, I mean, totally understand what's the opportunity if this is solved. Hopefully, of course, and there's also a big urgency around it.
And I like, maybe if I can interrupt you, Ton, I really like the phrasing of making it an opportunity, because that's also something that we kind of need, I feel, maybe in more spaces, you know. Of course, we can talk for hours about the problem and the issue and all the negative, like putting it in a negative daylight. But actually, we can also look at it as an opportunity. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but I think that's what we need to do more as well, trying to make people aware of the opportunities it has and that we are still able to, you know, solve this problem. Technologically, everything is solvable. I mean, that's no issue. But it's also the way how we, if we really want it and stuff like that. So I like that phrasing.
Well, thanks. That's no problem. It is an opportunity because you have to look at it from two sides. And that's possibly also how you can actually mobilize people to do something about it themselves. I have come some questions around that as well later on. But then you start the company in November 21, as far as I could see on LinkedIn. Then you got this wealth of technology available. There's many ways to approach the problem possibly. What has been an early decision that has appeared to be really important for where you are right now?
So if we go back to 2021, first of all, what I think was really important for us is that during the development stage, so as maybe it's good to explain, but we are a spin-off from 4-year PhD research together with these Dutch drinking water utilities. So you can imagine that something that comes out of a research is really nice and has high potential, but also needs kind of validation and so on. So I think what was really important for us and crucial is that we were able to also after this research develop it and validate it with real utilities instead of us kind of already going for external funding to, you know, boost the development of the product. Now actually we're able to bootstrap it for a serious amount of time to get this validation and to bring it to a certain level that we say, okay, this really has high potential, we can prove it, and it also gave us the feedback that we needed to build a good development plan. I think that's really crucial.
Let me make a small interruption here. Robert just made an excellent remark that sets the scene for long-term success of his business, getting the foundations right before considering external funding. This approach not only gives you validation of the market itself, but also what is required in order to make the biggest possible difference to get traction. It sets you up for what I call funding freedom, a status of your business that gives you options. If you ever want to go the funding route, it's an option, not a set choice. And that gives you a far better negotiation position. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They focus on the essence, they master the art of curiosity, and then they aim to be different, not just better. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Yeah. Maybe for kind of the picture of the people listening to this, what is the product that you're actually developing?
Yeah, it's a good one. So in short, as I said, coming shortly back to the problem, 30% of this water is being lost. So new leaks are happening day in, day out. And for water utilities, it's quite hard to understand that there is a leak and where it is. And they have limited sensors in their network measuring, for example, pressure and flow. So this is the challenge. And what we've built for that is basically an AI and physics-based software that is capable of using the existing pressure and flow sensors that are positioned already in the network for different purposes to detect, size, and localize new leaks in the network. And that typically reduces the time that they are now busy with that specific activity. So the time that they need to repair the leak eventually, which can take up weeks, we can reduce it now up to, let's say, 1 day. And it's not that we want to save that time, but that time of technicians, which are also becoming more and more scarce, they can use actually to find more of the existing leaks. because coming back to the problem, also already 30% of water is being lost. So that also we should find those existing leaks as well. So yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah, I mean, I can vividly see that happening here on the mountain where I live. Literally every month, there's two or three of those occasions.
Okay.
And yeah, it's horrible. And these are, of course, small leaks, but imagine there are some big ones. Wow, okay. And so you use AI for that? You connect it to the sensors? Okay, I can get a picture of that.
That we don't do anything with the hardware itself, so we don't touch that really. So we basically make connection with that sensor data that is already there, and then we push back the alarms that are basically giving them the insights.
Yeah, exactly. So how long does it take it to get such an installation going? I mean, likely, I think that's pretty quick because you plug it into an application like already.
Yeah, so that's coming back to your previous question, what is another critical thing and what we now sometimes also call our unfair advantage is that we really are interoperable. So meaning that indeed, on the one hand, we can deliver a platform, but on the other hand, we can also deliver an integration with existing platforms. So that makes it indeed fairly easy to implement our technology. But technology implementation, as you might as well know, is not only about implementing a technology, it's about how to use it and how people can trust it and so on. And that's also a nice thing is that our models, they only use 8 days of historical data, typically, where the traditional models actually require years of data, as you might know with machine learning. They're typically based on large data sets. So also training the models and with that, basically the time needed to give some kind of accurate and trustworthy insights is relatively small. So yeah, the ease of use and the trust you build up in a short time is typically perceived as impressive.
It must be always a proud moment when you're demonstrating this to a potential client where their eyes go up and then they see, okay, what's already happening in the network, something that I never knew before.
Now, it's actually funny that you named that because this is also a bit what we do. So before we start a commercial relationship, for us, we value our reputation a lot. And also the industry is really an industry of word of mouth. So what we always do is we do a kind of a bit of a feasibility audit is how we call it. So we ask for some data, you know, historical data. For us to see, okay, how feasible do we think it is? But then also to showcase these utilities like, hey, what can we do with only a couple of hours? And how quickly are these models learning on that data? And then indeed, what you said happens sometimes. And that's indeed cool. But it's not that you're proud then of the technology, but actually it gives a good feeling that you can really add value to them and help them in their daily jobs. And I think that's what brings a smile to our face.
Exactly. Completely agree. So knowing also the water utility market is typically a public market, you know, they go by tender, they are risk averse. Knowing, first of all, like they come with the problem, how does that appear to be in real life, you know? What are the objections you typically get? And is it more like a push or a pull that you're seeing?
Good question. I would say that it differs per geographical market. So I think, first of all, strategically, we had to find out like which countries, where is the problem perceived as biggest, so to say. So where is the willingness to change something there? Then I believe if that willingness is there, then whether they are public or private, they have this, you know, pull effect. And I think the topic is also, let's say, mature enough that we do not really have to create new markets, but the markets are there and they are already requesting for methods like this. Actually, they're already trying to solve this for decades, but they haven't been able to find, let's say, an appropriate solution that is, on the one hand, something that they can purchase because typically it's quite expensive to install a lot of hardware and stuff in the network to be able to get this level of insights. And that's a bit what we're changing. So we're actually offering them a new way in the industry. And yeah, then sometimes that is an objection, of course, like, hey, this is new. So we did this already for 30 years like this. So, but on the other hand, they all feel the pressure or the urgency of changing. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you make a couple of interesting remarks there. And that reminds me of a podcast that I did, I think in year one, in like 2018 or 2019 maybe, whereby there was a company that was actually doing something similar, but then was sort of with robots that when actually went into the pipes.
It's really, it's fun because that's actually the company, or I don't know if that's the company, but actually previously this, so Hulot got established with three founders of another company. So it's called Acquaint, and they built kind of robots to do condition assessments of pipelines in the water and wastewater industry. And there really we had to create the market, like we needed to teach them like, or actually almost make them aware of the problem and the challenge, like replacing the right pipes. And that's completely different here indeed.
Yeah. Now, this was from the United States, and it was about, you know, the old pipes, new pipes, and when do you actually, when is the right moment to kind of replace those pipes? Because, it's a lot of hassle. All right. Exactly. So what I like what you're saying there. It's typically, of course, your ICP is, of course, companies that do a lot with water. And what you kind of added to that was that you actually are looking for markets whereby the sense of urgency is bigger than others, which appears strange, but of course, yeah, it is the case. Because I think, like you're saying, if it's 30% leaking versus 5% leaking, the perception is going to be radically different in terms of sense of urgency. So do you see a difference between the Netherlands, how they pick it up versus like countries like Spain?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, the percentage is just a number because in Norway, for example, also, I believe the average water loss is also at least above 20%. But there, it was never perceived as a problem because they had big snow decks, water almost pure melting down from the mountain. So plenty of water. So who cares that water is leaking? I mean, that's the thing. But in Spain, for example, then it becomes way more an issue. And even in the Netherlands with 5% of water loss, you might think like, they don't feel this urgency. But also, since you're Dutch, maybe you might know the water availability. So you could call it water stress or water availability. And the water availability is becoming lower and lower. So water utilities, they don't get the permits anymore to get new sources of water, and specifically groundwater. The waters from the surface, so rivers and so on, they get infected by different kind of contaminants more and more. So even there, the reserves they have on, let's say, peaks in hot summers, they become smaller and smaller. So it really takes some more time and thought to assess whether a market or a geographical country perceives it as a problem, yes or no.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, but then you bring your product to market, you get into these discussions, you start to see early traction. Has there at any point in time been a moment whereby you say, hey, we're at sort of a, what we believed was going this way, and it appears to be that we have to change course to adjust what the market really needs, like a pivotal moment?
Really good question. Let me think. Has there been any pivot? I wouldn't say a real big one. So that we needed to change, let's say, the route completely. Obviously, the sequence in which we kind of develop things might have changed a bit over time. So where in the beginning we were really focused, like, okay, we need to, you know, have a kind of a platform, you know, that we need to provide them with insights. Actually, what we saw is that the most added value at the moment for our customers that we now serve is in, let's say, the alarm and the insights that's coming from the alarm, not that they have a screen in an operation room, something like that. So building the MVP, and that's again what I stressed in one of the previous answers as well, like that we developed this together with utilities, brought us a lot of value. So that you could call that a bit of a pivot, but it's more in the sequences and prioritizing things than doing things completely different.
Okay, but it makes sense.
Yeah,
and that can be pivotal in terms of the growth that you're experiencing.
Definitely.
Yeah. In this market, you know, I mean, if I look at there's been at least four or five of those sessions in my podcast that I've been talking about water technology, which is a number. How competitive is this market? Is this something that is indeed only like the water capital of the Netherlands, or is it something whereby you see a lot of companies jump on the problem? And how do you perceive that as something good or something that is like threatening to the business?
This is a global problem, so it also has global competition. Let's be honest about that. So there is definitely competition. It depends on how you look at it. So if you talk about leak detection, yeah, it's a really broad topic. And like I said, you have existing leaks which they need to find. They have new leaks and so on. So if we focus on, let's say, real-time monitoring of a water distribution network, we have a couple of competitors. And for us, that actually is not a bad thing because it's actually how we got established in the first place in the Netherlands. Dutch utilities already testing a lot of different technologies, but couldn't get the insights that they wanted with the limited information and sensors they had. So that's what we see in other countries as well, that actually they open up the market already and we can come in very, thoughtful, like, hey, we have something where you do not have to invest in all these hardware and all these valves and so on. And it's easy to implement. So for us, it works, I would say, quite well.
I mean that's it keeps you sharp, and at the end, the problem is large enough to together you
Definitely.
solve it.
Definitely. And it
So it's
also it isn't not one technology will solve the problem. And that's why we also really like this interoperability, that you kind of not want to do everything, but you focus on what you are good at and I focus on what I am good at. Then together we have, let's say, an even better proposition. And that's what we try to do.
Yeah, smart. Like you say, you cannot solve all the problems. So focus on where you are, where you have a strength, where you can really make a difference, and see it as an ecosystem whereby, combining different technologies can create a bigger impact. I like that. Let me see. Yeah, how fast you've grown over the last couple of years, 3 years in business. I mean, do you consider you have already found product market fit so far?
Yes, I would say we have found it. So we have paying customers in the markets that we want to focus on that we have selected so far. So definitely also we have proven metrics on the pipeline. We have a what we call sales machine. So it's designed instead of just doing sales. So we say sales is a science and not an art. We followed it this winning by design methodology. And so I would say yes. Obviously, as you can imagine, this industry, we have to work with long lead times, especially in the beginning when you kind of are entering new markets. We're at this, I would say, tipping point at the moment. Last year, November, so 1 year ago, we secured pre-seed investment round by two VCs from the Netherlands. And now we're 1 year ahead. So I would say the answer is yes. But on the other hand, we're also modest Dutchies, and we have a long way to go. That's the other side, but we are ambitious enough to make that happen, I would say.
So, I mean, you say long lead times, and going back to that urgency, what do you believe creates that long lead time? If the urgency is there, if the other side actually sees the need, if actually asked for the product in the first place.
Yeah, that's a good question. And the short answer is, yeah, we work with kind of enterprise customers, and next to that, in some regions, public or kind of semi-governmental organizations, which comes with the well-known fact, I think, that you have a lot of decision makers on such a thing. So a lot of I don't like to say the name bureaucracy, but to some extent it is like that, and that's simply how it works. And what we need to do on that is that we know about it and we know best how to navigate through that landscape, because you can kind of design for it, and if you know who are your decision makers and how that process goes, then that lead time can be way shorter. And I think we do a good job on that.
What have you learned over time then that has particularly worked well? I mean, you've got one anecdote that once you figure that part out, it's okay.
Yeah, I have a nice one for that, because there is one saying, and I don't know who I should quote here exactly anymore, but there are more pilots in the water industry than in the airline industry. And it has to do with the fact, or with the thing, is that the industry, and I think many industries, they like to talk a lot about innovation and collaboration and all these things, which is of course great and must be going on. But at the same time, doing innovation has always been a difficult thing, and changing the way or the status quo. And we made this mistake in the beginning once that, you know, we got in touch with a water utility, the innovation department, and all really nice, cool technology, and this could really help us, without knowing really who we were talking with. And that's, I think, what you see happening a lot, is that you do pilot for sake of doing a pilot. And nowadays, we learned from that, and we never do pilots or anything solely with a innovation department, but of course always influencing or including the business and the operations as well.
Oh yeah, we have so many deep discussions on that level that I run a weekly mastermind with SaaS CEOs from around the world, and this is a returning topic, you know, the doing the proof of concept. And I've seen companies doing proof of concepts when they were way beyond product market fit, scaling a company, which is completely not needed anymore. To add to this conversation here, as another idea, is that I've seen many successfully transition to we sign a contract. The first part, of course, is, you know, we're going to set it all up, and in 3 months' time, if it doesn't work, you know, you can still bail out of the contract.
Yeah.
And the idea at the end is that you get not only the buy-in, but also, skin in the game.
Yeah.
And the proof of concept is often something whereby they put the lowest qualified people on.
Yeah, definitely. And so what we nowadays do, to elaborate a bit on that as well, is really, like I said, we designed this sales process, and we really show them in the first meeting, like, okay, this is our onboarding process, and for this step, we need these kind of personas, then the implementation is most successful, and so on. And that's what they typically like. And next to that as well, trying to place KPIs into a kind of pilot or proof of concept. Then I don't care whether you call it a proof of concept or a pilot, but if we reach those KPIs, then which we will set up together, then we're both happy. So then let's also have the skin in the game and commitment to go to a full-scale contract.
Perfect. Well, that's efficient, I would say.
And it is difficult sometimes, because also, again, these utilities, they sometimes do not have, it can also slow down the process, I would say. So you ask them to sign already for something bigger that is really insecure. So they have to be really aware of what they sign for. So, but at least making them aware of it and really sketching that expectation already helps.
Yeah, but I mean, at the end, you help them to make the best possible decision, and you lead with the value you're going to provide.
Yeah.
And if that value isn't clear at that point, you know, then it's no time for a proof of concept or a proof of value yet, because other objections have to be covered first.
Yeah.
Looking at the time. Now, last question. I mean, from your entrepreneurial journey so far, looking back, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other entrepreneurs that want to accelerate the journey they have in building a company?
Good question. Let's start with the things that I would not do. I think, first of all, what you should not do is focus only on the product and on the technology. And I think it's really important, and I'm going towards a do already, to involve your end customers as soon as possible in the process, to get, first of all, feedback, but also to understand a bit, okay, where should we actually move towards? So I think that is a temptation to think that you know what the industry needs, but actually, who are you to know? Like, did you actually talk with the people that will use your product in the end? So still something we try to reflect on a daily basis. On the do side, I would also really recommend to, if you build a company and you're really at the start, I think having co-founders from the start of, beginning with thinking about the diversity of the team, like building on the founding team, but also on building your let's say team within the company. I think it's really important to look at those kind of things, like, okay, am I building a high performing team? And you know the sayings of Steve Jobs and everything, of course, but actually it is true. Like you need to hire people that are, first of all, better in something than you are. It's definitely worth it. And you need to be able, I think, to set aside your pride that you are the one and that is important. Now, actually, it's the team. And I like this. It's a bit in my, how I am. But I think it's really important to do. And we get positive feedback on that. So that's what I could recommend. But furthermore, I'm also just beginning. So who am I to say it? Probably I will still learn a lot in the coming years. I hope so.
Oh, always, you know. I had a career of about 26 years at Unit 4, and you're coming out of Unit 4 and you start your own business and you think, I know everything.
No, yeah, yeah.
I was pretty wrong on that one.
Yeah.
I mean, what you were just saying, this sparked one more question, which I want to ask. How has your definition of success for your company evolved since you started?
So we have one really clear definition, and that is in the amount of water that we have saved. So in the end, that relates to all our goals, because if we save so many Olympic sized swimming pools of drinking water, which is 4 billion is our BHAG, how you want to call it, then it also means that we probably built a very profitable company. That also means that we made a huge impact on the world. So that's our way of putting it, and a nice thing people can relate to it. So.
Well, it's not only that people can relate to it; it's actually what matters to everybody that's involved, whether it is employees, customers, investors, and anybody. You know, at society level, all the way down. I like that as well. You know, if you measure your success by the impact you help your customers create, value will come your way. So, kudos for that. Perfect.
Thank you.
So where can people go to find out more about Yulo or to say hi to you?
First of all, you can find me on LinkedIn or go to our website, hulo.ai. Always feel free to reach out. And if I can help, inspire, or whatever, please let me know. That's a bit my strategy, to find people around me that know more than I do and are willing to help me. So I always want to do this back to others as well.
Perfect. Nice. It's generous. Thanks.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Robert, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Robert Lodewijks, CEO of Hulo AI. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.